Welcome, everyone. I feel kind of a stubborn insistence to make this work on the ground. So how's the sound back there? I want to make sure that works all right, too. Can you up a little bit? Okay. How's that? Okay. So please let me know if you can't hear at any point. Can you hear in the back? Okay. Okay. I'm going to start first just by expressing my gratitude to Rodney for inviting both Tim and I to be here during the weeks that he's away teaching at the Forest Refuge. So I really enjoy picturing him there because it's such a heavenly realm. I'm sure it's a little bit of everything, but on the material level, it's such a wonderful place to practice, so I feel grateful that he's there and that he's asked us to be here. And I'd like to do something a little bit different tonight, not too crazy, but I'd like to work with a story. And so that's the sheet that I gave you. The reason that I asked you to wait to read it is that I'd like us to read it together as a group. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background beforehand. So if you've already read a little bit, that's fine. But just wait so I can offer you a little bit of background if you haven't. So this arose out of a non-residential women's retreat that I attended a couple of weeks ago here in Seattle with 20 other Dharma leaders from all different Buddhist lineages. And it was led by two women from Norman Fisher's Sangha in Northern California, two Zen teachers from his Sangha. And for the past few years, they've been putting together a book of stories, a collection of stories. They went through many different ancient texts from all Buddhist traditions, trying to find stories in which there were stories of women awakening. So women were the primary players in these stories, and in their own voices they were waking up or transforming. So as you know, a lot of the ancient texts have tended to feature men and their experiences in monasteries. So this was quite a labor to go through and find these stories and put them together in one collection. And they're wonderful. They're stories of women who are grandmothers and mothers, who are waking up in the process of pouring tea or selling rice cakes on the side of the road or in heated dialogues with one another. So there's a spirit of playfulness about them. They're mostly stories about meetings, about human interaction, and about dialogue. So I was quite inspired by this collection and by the way that we worked with them over the weekend. So during the weekend, we were invited to spend time in silence, to read the stories out loud together, to receive them that way, and to pick kind of a word or phrase or one particular piece that resonated with us, and then offer a response. So there was a wonderful sense of kind of dynamic exchange about this. And that's kind of what I would like us to work on for the next couple of weeks together. They approached these stories. The teachers are named Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And the book is called The Hidden Lamp. And they approach the stories, they actually call them koans. So they approach them with the spirit of questioning that is at the heart of koan practice. And they were very reassuring that you don't have to be a Zen scholar, that you don't have to be a Zen practitioner, or even a longtime Buddhist meditator to benefit from these stories, that these are human stories. But with the spirit of koan, we can take something like this and enter into it with a mind of not knowing, a mind that doesn't try to grasp the meaning analytically, try to really understand it or dissect it intellectually, but really understands more of the spirit or the essence of it over time, lets it kind of permeate and steep and affect us, affect each one of us, and then we can offer some kind of response to that. So it was really approached in the spirit of koan. And this has really reconnected me with the heart of Rodney's teaching, which I think of as the heart of his teaching and what he would probably say is the heart of his path, which is this spirit of questioning, of holding an open question, not assuming somebody else's version of truth or some belief, but the ability to hold a question in the mind, in silence and in quiet. And Tim spoke a lot the last couple of weeks about some of our long-held assumptions or beliefs that are unexamined, that can guide much of our behavior. And the spirit of questioning really dives right to the heart of some of these long-held beliefs. It's a wonderful way to turn right towards them. If you think about it, when you hold an open question, kind of turns the intensity or the brightness up on mindfulness. And you say, what is this? The mind pauses for a moment. There's a bit of stillness. There's a not knowing. And there's a curiosity. So there's a heightened attention before we rush in with an answer. So it's like we're poised and perched on the edge of not knowing. So I have an 8-month-old son. As I've been thinking about this, I've been watching him, and he can be in the middle of the most intense screaming fit, turning bright red, the world is totally miserable, and we'll go up to the oven door, and he'll put his hands on the door of the oven, and he'll go back and forth, and he'll open it and close it, and watch the light go on. Open, close, the light goes on. And is absolutely mesmerized by this. Just 1 minute before, the world was miserable, and now his attention is completely transfixed by this. So there's this kind of open spirit of curiosity that really is the innocence of the mind. So when we hold an open question, I think we return back to that kind of innocent curiosity that doesn't quite know yet, that doesn't have an answer yet, that doesn't have it all figured out. And that can cut through a lot of our habitual assumptions. And if we turn the innocence of the mind towards a question that's vitally important to the heart, what is this life? What is being alive? What's my deepest intention? We turn that curiosity towards something in the heart desperately wants to know. It's a very powerful combination, a very powerful way of understanding and approaching things. So the story that I've chosen, I've sat with every day for the last few weeks. And each day it's revealed something a little bit different. On the surface, it's kind of relatively superficial and kind of linear, but each day that I've sat with it, something new has emerged. One day I thought, oh, the whole Eightfold Path is right here. The Four Noble Truths are right here in this story, embodied. Another day, there was a phrase, people are complete as they are. And that phrase stayed with me for the whole day. It served as a kind of pointer, reminder, reflection for the entire day. With happiness, it's another little phrase that's in there. So my intention in bringing this forward is not to analyze it, dissect it, or really make it into a literature class in which you feel like you have to get it right. It's really to offer my own reflections very subjectively and allow you to come up with your own questions. These stories and koans in general are meant as mirrors for us to reflect back the things that might be of vital importance to us. So they really are meant in that, in the spirit of offering a mirror. So the woman in the story, her name is Chiono, and she's a Japanese woman from the 13th century. And you'll see she begins as a servant. This is a story of her transformation. She goes on to become the leader of many monasteries in Japan, including the leading female convent at the time. And she was the first woman to receive transmission in the Zen lineage. So she's one of their most respected ancestors and one that they honor regularly. Her name, Chiono, is her common name, and her Dharma name is Mugai Nyodai. And in 1998, they celebrated her 700th, the 700th anniversary of her passing at Columbia University in New York. So her influence is still penetrating even today. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to her. And I'll read this story out loud. It's quite short, as I mentioned. And you can read along with me if you'd like, or you can just sit with your eyes closed, whichever you'd prefer. It's called Chiono's No Water, No Moon. Chiono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice Zazen. Zazen is the name of meditation in the Zen tradition. One day she approached an elderly nun and asked, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of the Buddha, even though I have no skills?" The nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen." Chiono said with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life practicing day and night." After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightenment poem was this: "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell." So let's just sit quietly with that just for a moment. And you might just notice what the effect is on your body mind. maybe there's some anticipation, maybe some delight, confusion. Just notice what's present after the reading. And then if there are any phrases, sentences, images that resonate with you, that you remember, maybe either because they hold significance or might not even understand them fully, but any phrases or pieces that stand out. So one of the reasons that I chose this story is that it's the story of a journey, of a path of practice. So it's tempting to go right towards the end, towards her enlightenment poem, and try to figure that out. But I actually think it's much more interesting to take it as a whole, to take it kind of step by step, the conditions that lead up to that insight or transformation. So again, I want to just offer a few of my own reflections as we go through, mostly to spark your own questions. So it seems like a journey that progresses in a few parts, and she starts out with this question. Can I practice? And then she's given the reflection by the elder nun who gives her an invitation and a teaching. And then she moves into her own practicing with the teaching, her own way of kind of integrating it. And then she has this shift in view. So it seems like it moves through each of these four pieces. But she starts with this question. I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write. I work all the time. Is this possible for me? So she's in these difficult circumstances that on the surface don't seem conducive to awakening. And this is really the place that most of us start. And we can find ourselves here again and again. We're identified with the difficult circumstances around us. We think that they define who we are and what our capacities are. And it seems hard to envision what practice will look like. So often you'll hear this in a very straightforward way in the beginning class. You know, I'm a divorced mother with three kids. I have no time. I work all the time. Is it possible for me to practice? Or I'm a lawyer. I work 60 hours a week. You know, is it possible for me to practice? Does this have something to do with me? There's so many different scenarios. I'm uneducated. You know, I don't know anything about this Buddhist stuff. Is this possible for me? Or I'm overeducated. I have three PhDs. I'm paid to use my analytical brain. I'm praised for it. And you want me to get rid of it. Is this practice possible for me? I'm a very active person. I need movement. I can't sit here all the time. I have ADD. I'm depressed. Is this possible for me? So if we can feel the energy of this question, like the sincerity of it, and just the humanity of feeling kind of captured by our circumstances and defined by our circumstances. So we ask this question with interest, and we have to, of course, see for ourselves and live out the answer to that over and over again. But the nun, offering her reflection and her wisdom, doesn't say, "Oh, you're right, this is terrible. You know, better luck next lifetime." She offers her a very different mirror. It's very unexpected. She says, "This is wonderful, my dear. This is wonderful." So she offers her kindness and also a completely different view on what her circumstances are and also on what she's capable of. So she says, "Awakening is already in you, and her circumstances are no, your circumstances are no obstacle." So one question that I've been holding in my own practice is the questioning of how parenting might be a deepening of my spiritual practice and path. How does that, what does that look like? How is that a deepening? And many of you I know have already explored this question in some depth over the years, but this is quite new for me, and I had one person, one teacher who I respected, say in kind of an offhanded way, "Oh, your practice just falls apart when you have kids. That's just how it is. For a while, it just falls apart." And I have to say that my reaction to this, it sparked a bit of fear and was kind of taken aback by this. It felt like a very strong statement. There's a bit of fear that I would lose some spaciousness or commitment to practice. So this is one of the kind of unexamined, inherited, almost cultural assumptions that Tim was speaking to last week, that dedicated practice, that inquiry can't go along with a family or having children, that those two can't go together. And I didn't realize that under the surface I was still holding a remnant of that belief. So when that fear came, I looked right towards it and had begun to examine it. So is this really true? Like a good student of Rodney's, is this really true? Is it possible? And so asking that over and over again. And a few nights ago, I was in the car on the way to give a talk and happened to notice as I looked down that there was milk all over my pants. Okay, well, that's interesting. And I noticed that I was driving extremely slowly. And what I've noticed in being fatigued is that my reaction times are quite slow. And so as I'm driving, I kind of overcompensate and drive extremely cautiously and slowly. So it takes me a long time to merge into traffic and an unprotected turn. I wait a very long time until there are no cars. So there are people honking behind me, and I'm getting a bit flustered and rattled. And I finally arrive at the destination, and I'm sitting in the car trying to kind of reconnect with my intention and ground myself a bit. And I close my eyes and realize that if I keep my eyes closed for more than about 4 or 5 seconds, that I will fall completely asleep, like just dead asleep. So I'm looking around at this situation, and like, this looks a little discouraging to me. And this woman's voice came, "Your practice just falls apart when you have kids." And that fear came. And then this koan came. "Oh, this is wonderful, my dear. This is wonderful. These circumstances are wonderful." And it wasn't in a cheeky, sarcastic way. It was actually felt like the wisdom and the lightness of that mirror of my own potential coming forward in that moment. And so there was a shift. And I kind of gathered myself, opened the door, walked in, and it was fine. I offered what I could. Some people probably got something out of it, others didn't. But the struggle was gone. So holding that question, and wisdom came forward. So last week, as someone was reporting from their groups about some of these unexamined or unexplored beliefs, they made the really interesting observation that a lot of the unexplored beliefs were negative. A lot of our unexamined, deeply held beliefs were negative, and they asked this question, are there ever positive beliefs that I'm not aware of that are governing my behavior? And on reflecting of this and my experience in the car, this belief that it's possible, that transformation is possible, and that our circumstances are workable, is a very strong, motivating belief. It's a belief that has to carry us until we can see directly for ourselves. So the belief that it's possible is a very strong motivator, and this is what occurred to me in the car until I could re-remember. So in that moment where we're feeling overwhelmed, identified by our circumstances, there's a choice. I could really be overwhelmed by that feeling of fear and confirm those assumptions. Confirm those old, habitual, cultural assumptions. But with that bit of faith or the belief that this is possible, there's the energy to look again, to see again. And so in that choice, you can actually see part of the investigation in questioning is being able to see which thoughts lead towards release, towards freedom, and which thoughts actually lead towards more suffering. So there's a choice point there. So you can see there's a lot here. I'm only on the second paragraph. But there is only this. So that's the next piece. There is only this. And that could be the whole passage, right? There's only this. But there's a hyphen. And we could fill this in. It's interesting to reflect. How would you fill this in? There's only this. What is that for you? What is the cornerstone of your practice, of your understanding? But the nun offers, each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. So this is our deepest intention. This is the intention that says, let me awaken, let my heart open, and let me keep close to that, because there's energy and power in that. So sometimes when people aren't able to contact what their deepest intention is for their life or their practice, I think it's helpful. John Wellwood uses the terms holy longing. And sometimes getting in touch with it in this way can feel a bit more direct. We can access the energy of our intention a bit more. What is it that we most deeply long for in our life? Not just what will make us more comfortable, what will be pleasant for the moment, but what is it that we most deeply long for? Coming to the end of our life, what will have most deeply been of value? Touching the energy of that before it becomes a strategy or a plan of how we're going to get there contains in some way, it feels like to me when I sit with it, a wholeness that's already present. So it kind of contains its own completion, or the seeds of its own completion, when we stay just with that purity of that longing. There's the saying, that which you are seeking is causing you to seek. So there's something in that that already knows its own wholeness, already knows its own completion, and that whatever it is that we're deeply looking for is already right here. So these are words we've heard again and again, but we can revisit them in our own way, holding our own question. So the sense that we're already complete. Jack Kornfield refers to this as the inherent nobility of heart. When we're in contact with this, in this moment, I'm already complete, already whole, lacking nothing. There's an integrity and an uprightness to that. This is not the usual way that we move through the world. There's a nobility of heart. Chogyam Trungpa speaks about this in a beautiful way too, how this is connected with our deepest aspiration. He has a book called Smile at Fear. And this is from the afterword of this book, from his editor, Carolyn Rose Gimian. She says, Rinpoche used the metaphor of royalty to address the human aspiration for a good, uplifted, and fulfilling life. He had a somewhat democratic view of monarchy, in that he felt that every human being can play this role in his or her own life. I remember once hearing from some friends how Rinpoche had spent an evening describing each of them as they would appear when they became a Buddha. Not if, when. People are complete as they are. And then there's the compassion, awakening the compassionate heart, because it's so easy to forget this again and again, and we suffer when we're separated from this again and again. So the nun also points Chiono towards the source of her delusive thoughts. So you're already complete, but it's your delusive thoughts that are creating a sense of separation. If you want to understand, you have to turn towards the source of your delusive thoughts. So as we're turning towards the thoughts, as Tim mentioned again last week, we can begin to get a sense of, by asking ourselves, what am I believing in this moment? And what's the effect of having this belief? So this belief that I'm separate, this belief that I am unworthy, this belief that these circumstances are insurmountable, what is the impact of that belief? So those things go very closely together. The beliefs are, as we know, tied up with wanting and fearing. So on their own, they're just words, but they have this enormous drive and push to them, impact. That's the wanting and fearing. So noticing what the beliefs are and what they're being fueled by, what the source of them is, and can we turn directly towards that with our questioning? What am I believing in this moment? What am I wanting? What am I fearing? It's a very powerful way to access our wisdom. When we hold the question, it becomes our own. It doesn't become somebody's inherited or adopted value system. We can access it directly. So the nun offers her both a reflection of her potential, of her capacity, of that in her which is already complete, but also where the source of delusion is. So these two things together are really powerful, and we need both. Suzuki Roshi said when he was looking out on a crowd of people, you're all completely perfect exactly as you are, and you could all use a little work. So it's a wonderful quote, and we need to hold both of those. So the feeling, a glimpse even of our own completion, offers a sense of lightness, and the needing a little work offers an invitation to turn towards the source of our suffering or whatever's clouding our view. I think it's also helpful to ask, because in this passage, Chiono receives an invitation. The nun invites her into practice. and offers her this mirror. It's helpful to reflect on who invited you into practice, who reflected that potential or your own capacity. And calling them to mind regularly, I think, can reawaken that sense, that wisdom. So then she goes about her practice. Chiono said, "With happiness, with this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life practicing day and night." And she practiced wholeheartedly. So this actually reminds me of in sports movies or in movies where there's some kind of a training for something. Often there's like an underdog team that starts off really overweight and out of shape, and they're training up for a big event. And there's a montage scene in the middle of the film where there's some music playing, and there are clips of them working out, you know, running, sweating, falling down, getting back up again. And, you know, it's meant to show that time is passing and that a lot of work is being done. And somehow in this, they're transforming into a readiness for the big event. And so this happens in the span usually of a couple minutes in a movie, but this is actually where most of the down and dirty work gets done, right? And in this passage, this line to me is conveying the same thing. So this is where she really commits diligently to practicing in her own way day and night. So with or without that theme music playing, she's practicing diligently, and this is the hard work. This isn't easy. This is the continuity of effort coming forward again and again. But it's also this phrase, "with happiness," has come back to me again and again also. So the first part of the happiness is that seed of faith has been awakened in her that it's possible. So she goes forward with the glimpse that she's already complete, that she doesn't need to get happiness, that she can actually move forward with it already. But also she can practice with happiness, with some of this sense of uplift and integrity. And I have to share, this is kind of random, but I was working on the talk in a tea shop. I had some of my notes gathered around me and was thinking about this phrase, "with happiness." I was trying to assemble everything into some kind of coherent piece, little scribbles of paper. And all of a sudden, I hear the people next to me erupting in song. And it was "Que Sera Sera." And it was a group of drag queens who were planning some event, and all of a sudden singing, you know, "Que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see," which lyrics I'd never really heard before in that way. "Que sera, sera." And it was just this completely unexpected moment where my mind did stop for a second, and there was just this, like, just this happiness erupting out of nowhere. And so teachings can come from everywhere, from the most unexpected places. And really, the stories in this collection have this kind of spirit of play and unexpected delight in them, which, when we're in the grit of the continuity of our day and night effort, can seem far off from us. So the sense that we can practice with happiness already, that we don't have to get to it, that we have it already, gives us quite a bit of energy. And this is where her mindfulness gains momentum. So it really gains a kind of force. And we need many reminders of this. So about the continuity of practice, I'll just say one more thing. since Kamala was here last weekend, I've been thinking about her a bit. I haven't, I didn't go to her weekend. But when she was young and raising three children and asking this very sincere question to her teacher, Manindra, how do I practice with three children? She said, you know, I have no time. I'm a single mom. And he said, well, certainly you have a half an hour or 45 minutes somewhere in the day. She said, actually, not sure that I do. And at some point he came to her house. He came to the U.S. to offer teachings, stayed with her in Maui, and watched her move through a day. And he said, you know, you're right. You don't have a half an hour to practice. But let's see what we can do. Let's see how we can work with this. And so he said, let me show you how to wash your dishes. Let me show you how to pick up each dish with care, with complete mindfulness, with presence. Let me show you how to focus your mind as you're moving through the hallway hundreds of times each day so that you're collected, you're gathered, you're concentrated, you're aware of where you are when you walk through each doorway. Let me show you how to do that so your practice can be moment to moment, day and night, continuous, and it doesn't have to be on long retreat. So I think it's helpful when we have mirrors and inspiration like this, as I was mentioning, to draw them to mind regularly when our faith lags, when it seems like drudgery, which it can at times, when it can seem like a chore. Let me see where I am. So in this last piece is her shift in view. This is where her view goes from being completely identified with her circumstances to kind of broken open in a way. So she goes out to gather the water, one of her daily moment-to-moment duties. And it's a full moon night, so there's the sense that it's radiant, that there's clarity, that maybe she's clear and concentrated, completely focused on this task, and that possibly, this is a bit of projection, but maybe the hindrances are diminished to some extent. Now, the hindrances, I've always found it interesting that they're compared to water in various states. So desire, ill will, restlessness, sloth and torpor, are compared to water that's either stirred up, muddy, dyed with a certain color, water that you can't see through, that can't reflect. So the mind's natural capacity is for clarity, to reflect, but we get clouded by these various states. So in this particular night, it seems as though the moon was reflecting in the bucket, that maybe her mind was clear. But the bottom of this bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. So in her poem, she says, with this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together. This was the first line that stood out for me when I read this. It's like the tension inherent in trying to keep things together, in trying to hold our world together, to maintain an image and keep it together. With this and that. So we each have our strategies of control in order to keep things together. So we can ask ourselves, when we're feeling fearful, when we're out of control, when we're confused, what is the way that we try to patch the bucket? How do we try to patch those strips and keep it solid, keep it contained? Some of us get very busy. Some of us get dutiful, trying to meet all of our responsibilities, fulfill our duties. Some of us reject anything that could be threatening. Some of us try to win approval. Some of us try to figure it all out to get an answer intellectually. And at some point, we do all of these things. But to really feel the energy and the tension of trying to hold things together. And then the bottom fell out. Because this is what happens to buckets, and this is what happens in life. All of our best efforts, the bottom falls out. So we can feel the impact of that. We come up against the limits of our own efforting, of our own strategies, and then at some point it no longer works. Something gives way. Our health starts to fall apart. Maybe our relationship ends. We fail at something. A plan we had, a direction we were going, suddenly doesn't work out. Some identity that we had carefully constructed and gotten a lot of praise for no longer holds up. We retire. And then what? The bottom can fall out in those moments. Umuro Kodo Boyd is a Zen teacher and activist from New Jersey. And she writes the reflection to this story in The Hidden Lamp. I forgot to mention that 100 contemporary women Dharma teachers all write their reflections to these stories in the book. So Heather Martin, Adrienne Ross, many contemporary teachers that we know offer their reflections in this book. And so Merle Kodo Boyd writes, "Hearing the words with this and that, I felt the exhaustion of years of vigilance, all aimed at protecting my idea of myself. I felt the exhaustion of being my own obstacle. In spite of our conditioning, we're called to awareness rather than vigilance." This is beautiful. We are called to awareness rather than vigilance. She talks about how keeping things together is a necessary skill at times and one that we often need. So she was part of the first generation of African American children raised in the South to enter desegregated schools. And so she mentions feeling the tension of trying to keep it together in public, trying to maintain control in public to avoid very real disaster or avoid violence in public. So how maintaining that, keeping things together, was an important skill to learn. And this is all part of it. We don't throw that away. We just realize that it has its limits. So she also says, we live between Chiono's first two lines and her second two lines, between keeping things from falling apart and letting them fall apart. So this whole process is a ripening and a maturing of practice. There's also the fruit of her practice coming forward. So Ajahn Chah often talks about the maturing of practice as like a ripening of a mango. It's always talking about mangoes for some reason. And how we want the mango to be ripe before it's ripe. And there's that moment when it's perfectly ripe and it just drops off the tree. And that happens in an instant and it's sudden and it just drops. And that's instantaneous, immediate. But all of the conditions that went up to producing that moment of dropping, all of that is a very gradual ripening process. So it's both gradual and sudden. And every piece of this has its place. So sometimes we can get very impatient in our practice of wanting to see progress, wanting to be further ahead than we are, wanting the bucket to fall apart so we can get that glimpse. But each step is an important part in the process. It's also important that she didn't make this happen. She couldn't force it to happen, that conditions were right. They ripened and they matured, and then it happened. And her shift is her own shift. I think it's important that it isn't even happening on retreat or in the presence of a great teacher. It's happening when she's at the well, and it's a direct knowing, a direct cutting through, and a direct seeing. So this image of the moon in her bucket that falls away. So we're often entranced by images, by concepts, by representations of the world. So the neuroscientists call this living life through a simulator. Living life as though we're in a simulator. We're looking at a representation rather than reality itself. So here, I think it's important, or what we can do is approach this from the perspective of science and also the perspective of art. So we need to kind of be both an artist and a scientist. And a scientist is very skillful at deconstructing something to find out why it happens. So we can do this and bring all of our interest and our ingenuity to that, to see what goes into making this image, what goes into the image-making mind. How is it that we get so entranced by a concept and by this seemingly solid, separate sense of self? So all of these things coming together, feeling, form, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, how do all of these things come together to form what seems solid and separate? How does the concept in our mind become more real than what we're actually seeing, what we're actually living? So we can deconstruct all of these levels that aren't real and really see that it's empty over and over again. So we're no longer completely convinced by that image. So when there is no self-constructing, when there's no patching the bucket, there's no separation. There's not two. But I think equally important is kind of the artful sense, or the sense of feeling that we get when we listen to something like this or read it. That what is that sense of letting go? What does it feel like when we're trying to hold things together? And what does it feel like to let go? So what is the taste of that? And we can get that just by reading, by sensing into her own experience, and by using that as a mirror. So when the heart and the mind empties, doesn't it also open? When the image dissolves, so what's left in that? The editors offer at the end of this passage these questions. Where does the moon go when its reflection disappears? Where do we go when we disappear completely? So I think it's interesting to imagine what she might have done when the bucket fell apart and that image vanished. And there she was in the moonlight, just there, present, awake. So who knows what that was like and what the ceasing of that separation was like. But I imagine that she was there with life in all of its fullness, with moonlight outside and inside. And I think it was Iris last week who asked the question, you know, in the emptiness, is there also a fullness? And Tim skillfully directed her back towards her own question of that. But when the bottom falls out, when there is this emptying, when that sense of separation, even for a moment, falls away, What is that like? We can all notice that. We can all have glimpses of that, and more than glimpses of that. Always available and present. And Buddhadasa, one of the things that I have been appreciating lately about his writings is he calls these moments of release temporary glimpses of freedom or free samples of nibbana. That sometimes I think we're afraid that we're going to cling to this, and so we almost don't notice it. But the heart mind can make an impression and can learn from that. Ah, this is what letting go feels like. This is what the tension of holding it together is like. This is what letting go feels like. This is what lack of separation feels like. And to notice that when they happen throughout the day. And like I mentioned at the beginning, this can seem like a very neat and linear story. So in a way, it's very from A to B. She starts out with the question, she gets the answer, she practices, and boom, that's it. So it can seem like a formula, and okay, you know, I'll just walk this step and that step. But I think, obviously, we're always all moving through all of these cycles again. So I think what's more true to life is that some part of us lets go, some fixation releases, we get a wider glimpse, and then we're back holding another question again. Wherever there's tension, wherever there's conflict or struggle, we're back holding another question with openness. We're back doing the work of moment-to-moment practice. And then after this, she goes on to establish convents for women. So she goes on to establish other places of practice so other women can practice in easier circumstances. She doesn't just say, well, I awoke as a servant in very difficult circumstances, so you can too. She doesn't neglect the realm of form. She says, well, let me do what I can on this level and make it easier for other people. So she's very active and engaged, making it easier and providing a mirror for each of us. So let's sit for a moment. So noticing how at the end of the question, the end of the words, there's just a very simple dropping back into quiet, to stillness. The wordless moving into words and back again into quiet. For this week, I'd like us each to just choose one part of this that will keep with us during the week. So a phrase, something that resonates, that seems to mirror back a vital question that you might be holding in your life just now. And be willing to let the answers come as you're living your life out. Maybe in your meditation practice as well, but let it come from mysterious sources throughout the day. You're complete as we are, turned towards the source with happiness, have only to go about my daily life. So if you'd like to at home, we can spend some time with this and see what resonates, or something from tonight's talk. And then next week, be willing to offer your response, to share how you were affected by it over the week, what you learned, what was mirrored back. So there's time for a few questions or comments. Anything that struck you? This is kind of a different format to work with. But there's a little bit of time. Have anything? I'm a terrible marketer. The book is called The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. And it's edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. Lovely book. Any other questions? Steve? Yeah. Yeah. Can you explain more about that image? Is the stepping off of a 100-foot pole? Is it that one?
No, when you talk about the ridge pole, then this structure, what is it? The ridge pole is your shadow. The ridge pole is shadow. Just the idea of the structure that we hold and how I'm getting it anyway.
Yeah.
And then letting go.
I think in this way, images can be very, very helpful. And this is what I was pointing to a bit with the art part of it, or approaching it as a piece of art, because images really stay with us in our mind, and we can get a felt sense of images. So there are so many similes in the Buddhist texts that sometimes those are almost more powerful than the words, because we can get our bodies, our nervous systems are lined up that way. We get a sense of how that feels. So to use those when they resonate, I think it's really, really helpful. Thank you. Lauren?
I think this connects to Tim's homework from last time. I was trying to do it, and I was bringing up some assumptions and beliefs, and then asking the question. But then Tim's homework said, the answer is in silence without any words. Mm. Don't be drawn to the words. Mm-hmm. And you said in the beginning about the open question. And could you just maybe say a few more sentences about that, how to be there without going? Well, it reminded me of the image of the moon, that the moon fell away.
Yeah.
And I wanted the moon, here's my question, and I wanted to, go for the answer. So it was really difficult to sit with this open
thing. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you for asking that. So the question, I'll just summarize, and I'll probably oversimplify it, but how to hold the question without going into the analytical, conceptual mind that really wants an answer. That somewhat, without moving into conceptual thought. Yeah. So let's look at that. When we hold an open question, the mind is in an open, spacious place of not knowing. So there's intensity and there's energy, because there is part of us that wants to know. But we have to kind of stay on that perch of not knowing without tripping over into the mind-generated answer. Right? Because the mind is so good at coming up with answers. It'll give you a million answers to what this means. And I feel like I was walking that line as I worked with it as well in trying to explain it. Holding the tension of that question And what it brings up is part of it. And then waiting. So we have to kind of wait in the quiet, but with that sense of expectancy. Waiting with the whole body, you know, in our meditation, but also throughout life. So I gave a few examples of how, you know, I've kind of been waiting with this open question. The answers come from very unexpected places. And it's not the absolute answer, but it's, you know, one piece of it that's allowed a bit of release or letting go. Does that speak to it a little bit? Okay. So we'll have more time for discussion next week. I hope you'll come, and if you come and remember to bring these, it'll help on the copy front. And Barbara has some announcements.